meditation, not prayer.
That was.
Prayer.
God, we offer this time to you. Just whatever you want to achieve during this space, just come and have your way. Just set us aside and do your thing. Just remove us and just have your way. Let your will be done. Amen.
Amen. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Brandon. Unlike others, I don't have any idea what I'm going to say, because God's going to speak through me and say whatever it is that I'm supposed to say, because that's the agreement that he and I made when I was setting this room up, when I was preparing the energy of the room, and when I was making sure that there was extra love in three specific chairs. It was fun to see who sat in them. Because I'm a big believer in energy and energy fields and what goes into like this thing that we call existence. And if you guys want to get real weird, we can get way out there, or we can just stay here and But what's clear to me from being around and listening to the conversations in the group and the people that are here is that usually when I go to retreats or conventions or weekends like this, there's a single energy source that's kind of like the source of it, and then it kind of dissipates out from there. And is clear to me just from the people that are here that are on the committee or part of the committee or peripheral to the committee is that there's so much energy just in the quantity of people that had something to do with getting us all here. And all those people have contributed a component of themselves to this weekend. And so there's a ton of power here. if you're willing to access it. If you're not willing to access it, well, then you're not going to get it. And so just before we get too far down the road, anybody that had anything to do with setting this thing up or organizing or planning it, please raise your hand. And let's give those people a big round of applause. Because there were so many of them that I was like, I can't remember who all, and I would leave somebody out. So I just wanted to make sure that we touched on that. So I'm going to start off with a reading, I believe. This is called Opportunity. A green bird darting in the night. Will you be able to see it? Will you be able to catch it? Cling to spirit like a shadow. Move without a shadow. Times of oppression and adversity cannot last forever. How is the transition made to new and better situations? In the midst of great opportunity, a tiny opportunity will open, if only by chance. You must be sharp enough to discern it, quick enough to catch it, determined enough to do something with it. If you let it pass, you will be filled with regrets. Stick to spirit like a shadow. Wherever it goes, you go. As soon as it throws something your way, catch it by sheer reflex. It is like the bird. If you try to catch it, you will miss it. If you are always with it, moving at its speed, as much a part of it as its own shadow, then it is easy to seize it. When you act, however, you must in turn have no shadow. In other words, what you do must leave no messiness, no leftover consequences, nothing that will haunt you later. That is one of the ways in which you can avoid creating more bad situations for yourself. Your every moment is traceless. So, for those of you who don't know me, which is most, I'll give you a little brief rundown on what got me here. Externally, everything looked pretty normal for a long time. I'm the first documented case of alcoholism, to my knowledge, on either side of the family. No trauma, nothing like that. But I'm alcoholic. I had this wonderful evening near the end of May in 2011 where I didn't want to exist anymore. Before then, I had considered the fact that I didn't want to exist. But there was always all those reasons, those what you might think of me or what would happen to my kids or would the life insurance hold up. Those were all the reasons why I didn't go through with it. But this night, it didn't matter. I was done. All the reasons for keeping me here in the physical plane had disappeared. I didn't want to exist anymore. And I stood outside with my dog by my side, the room where I kept the pistol. My kids were upstairs sleeping, and my wife was out with some friends. And I had made the resolution to go through with it, so it wasn't like I was pondering it. It was done. I had visualized it, and I kind of wondered, should I put the dog upstairs or not, because whether or not she had to deal with me or not. And I couldn't go into the room where I had the pistol. It was the strangest thing. There was no door, but it was like there was a force field keeping me out of that space. And continued to go back to the fridge and grab another beer and hope that eventually it would just take place and I would move on and that would be it. And for whatever reason, probably that it was getting late in the evening and she was going to be home soon, and I didn't do it. And so I went and grabbed my kids, put them in the car, took them over to a neighbor's, asked if they could spend the night. And then I drove an hour away to my parents' house and attempted to get into their house. And the key didn't work. And then woke up the next morning with my dad bumping me on his back patio, wondering what the hell I was doing on his back patio. And And that in that moment, I realized the mistake. Did I have a good reason for why I was there? Every other time anything had ever happened, Brandon had a plan, an explanation, and some sort of bullshit excuse for what was going on, and I forgot to do that this time. And so I asked my dad if he would go back inside, mostly so I could come up with the reason why I was there. And he obliged. And in that moment, this is the way I describe it, but this doesn't describe it. In that moment, the air was crisper, the sun was brighter, and the birds were louder, and the magnitude of the experience of the night before was thrust upon me, and I knew that it had something to do with alcohol, and I knew that I didn't want to ever return to that space. And it scared the hell out of me. And fear sobered me up for 4 days. And 4 days later, back at it. Within a couple of weeks, I went to this... We had a family vacation off the coast of South Carolina on an island with no bridge where you have to schedule your transportation on and off. And in the middle of that week, on that Wednesday, my wife announced to me and to her parents that she no longer wanted to be married to me, which was a shock to everybody but her. And I think it might have even been a shock to her. It's like when she said it out loud, she finally realized, oh, this is really what I want. And there was no undoing that. And so in that moment, lost house, wife, car, kids, everything that I thought was important, everything that I thought that I had constructed my life for. And I got to spend the following 4 days on that island with no bridge, with my in-laws and the mother of my children, with them telling me what was wrong with me. It was a great start to a six-step defect list. And I love it when alcoholics and addicts have plans. Like, they are some of the greatest plans. And my plan, it's a good plan, was I was going to return to work on Monday, make so much damn money that she was going to regret the day that she ever left me. And I started scheming. And then my mother-in-law suggested that perhaps I had an alcohol problem. Kind of news to me, because everybody I hung around with drank like I drank. Now, most people don't go through 8 jobs in 6 years and have the wreckage of their finances and everything around them and steal from their kids' piggy bank and all that stuff. Most people don't do that, but, you know, everything was okay, right? Nothing to see here. And so we returned from that vacation, and on that Sunday night, I'm doing one of those weepy, snotty cries, you know, the ones where you can't really catch your breath and you're like, and you're blowing bubbles out of your nose and things like that because it's just so awesome. And she's sleeping in the guest room and the dog won't even be in the room with me. Doesn't want anything to do with the energy I got. And I say probably the most perfect prayer I've ever said. I climb down out of the bed on my hands and I get down on my knees and I just say, God, I don't know if you exist or not. But if you do, please make it better. And then a sense of calm and peace came over me. I climbed back up in that bed, went to sleep, had a great night's sleep, got up, recharged, rejuvenated, went to work on Monday, and they fired me. So I had this complete failure at living, complete failure at dying, and I'm left with nothing but me. And I have this experience where God's grace enters into my life and a bunch of series of events happen to where I become teachable and I become open to the possibility that perhaps I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Perhaps I don't have it all figured out. And perhaps there's another way. A drinking buddy of mine who stopped showing up at the same parties, I ran into him within about a week or two after getting home, and I went and asked him if he was still being good, and he wanted clarification on what good meant. I was like, well, are you still not drinking? And he said, no, I'm not. And I said, are you going to meetings for that? And he said, I am. He said, why do you ask? I said, well, I was wondering if you could take me to a meeting. Now, let's just say it was a Tuesday. I have no idea what it really was, but let's say it was a Tuesday. And he goes, well, there's a meeting today at noon. I'm like, whoa. There's a meeting tomorrow at noon. In fact, there's a meeting every day, Monday through Saturday, that we can go to. I'm like, no. He's like, there's a Friday night one that I go to. No. So I negotiated Monday night, right? I negotiated this Monday night meeting, which was his home group, and we met his sponsor before the meeting, and he gave me a copy of a third edition big book, and I was like, you guys got a book? And he's like, oh yeah, actually, that's where the whole answer is, really. And he's like, I'm going to let you borrow this, you can read it, you can do whatever you want with it, and just return it at some point in time. And so we attended my first meeting, and they passed around the newcomer packet where you put your name and your phone numbers in it. I thought it was like roll. So I signed in, and they're like, no, that's for you. And I'm like, I know, I'm signing in. And then they gave out the chips at the beginning of that meeting, which was kind of a little bit different. And so I didn't know what I was supposed to do, so I didn't pick up a chip. But this guy, Bill, he sat in the middle of the room. He said, if you pray to God for direction, you better be willing to move your feet. And it stuck with me. And there are these little breadcrumbs along the way of, hey, pay attention. Notice the things that are going on. And then I audited AA for about 30 days. I did this thing where I would listen and judge. And try to figure out, like, who's full of shit in here, right? These people are really drinking. They're just not telling me they're drinking, right? Maybe they're doing other stuff. But what I noticed is that it seemed like any meeting I went to, there was like these 2, 3, 4, or 5 people that they were having a different experience with reality, right? There was something, you could look at it, you could look in their eyes, and you could see something different was happening in their existence, and then there was the rest of the people, right? There was the rest of the people just hanging around. And so I started watching, judging these people that had this different experience going on. And had this wonderful experience where I just got my first smartphone, and I got Pandora Radio, and God was speaking to me in the lyrics of the words I was listening to, and I started paying attention to them. I'm like, that's weird. That's just a coincidence, right? That can't really be any message for me. And then the next song would come on, and there would be a message in the song for me. And then the next song would come on, and there'd be a message in the song for me. And I was one of those guys where I would show up to the meeting, and I was always very well-dressed, clean-cut. Outside looks good. Inside has to be good, or at least you guys will think it is, right? Because I had no idea how to be an authentic human and show up for who I was. So if I look okay, then probably going to be okay, right? But this day, I had this experience where the words were speaking to me, and I made a deal with whatever God is at that point for me, and I said, all right, God, if you keep talking to me in these songs, then I'm going to go to the lunch meeting. I'm going to go to the noon meeting. And then the next song would talk to me, and I'd be like, if the next song, right? So like 8 songs later or something. I finally decided I'm going to book it to the meeting. But now I've been working over at my buddy's house because I was unemployed. I was installing trim in his house, and I had paint and caulk and everything all over me. And I had to show up to a meeting just dirty as hell. And I wanted to share this experience of the fact that God's speaking to me through these songs. You see, I hadn't shared yet. And God had me in this little trap where if I want to share, I got to say I'm alcoholic. But if I say I'm alcoholic, then I have to join this thing. And I honestly thought that once you joined, that meant you couldn't drink anymore. Relapse was not a part of my story. It was nothing I comprehended until I was about probably 4 months sober. Didn't know it was the thing. Ignorance is bliss. And so I came into this meeting, and I really, really wanted to, the meeting was on the third step, and it was like, whoa, no way. And I want to share this experience, but I have to say, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Brandon. And then I share the experience, and then I pick up my white chip, and then I pick up the 30-day chip. And I got, guys, this sounds so absurd to me now, but like that serenity prayer that this three lines long, I couldn't figure that damn prayer out. I'd looked it up. I tried to study it. I tried to memorize it. Couldn't get it. I'm all waterheaded still, right? My mind's not working properly. I pick up that 30-day chip, and I turn it over, and it's got that serenity prayer in it. I'm like, oh, I guess I should have done this earlier. And so I promptly pick a sponsor that I think I'm supposed to have, and it's a guy that's got a bunch of time, and he's trying to fumble through the book and explain to me how the circle and triangle works and all this stuff. And he's really butchering the experience. And so in about 90 days, there's this retreat at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit out in Conyers, Georgia. There's two twin brothers coming from Texas. One of them's got an eye patch and kind of fiery. And so the guy that was sponsoring me says, hey, I think you're supposed to go to this weekend since you like speakers so much. I was listening to speakers like on a loop in my car constantly. And one of the most profound experiences I was having was with this talk by this guy named Mark Houston called Hollow Bone. And he starts off his talk by doing his little laugh like he does. He goes, I love meetings that start with meditation because it gets me here. Because I've never been here before. In this space, with these people, in this time. Never been here before. And then he goes and talks about steps 10 and 11 like it's this like thing. Like, what is that? He talks about the fact that we've entered the world of the Spirit. This is new language, right? This is new language that we've never heard, we've never applied. We cannot practice steps 10 and 11 without an awakened spirit. And I'm interested. So I go to this retreat where there's about 50 some odd people, about the size of this retreat. And I walk into that room. And guys, the entire room was people who were having that experience where the lights were on. The entire room was a group of people who were hooked up with power. And I had none. I wasn't drinking, but I had no power. And so I did what I do. I started watching, judging, trying to figure out what these people were doing that was different than the rest of the people. And this is what I came to the conclusion of, is that these people had all worked the steps, and the majority of them had worked the steps as outlined in the book. And they were having a completely different experience with reality than I was. And I wanted to have that. So I promptly got a new sponsor from that retreat. And people talk about this thing called a pink cloud or whatever. I call it God's grace. And it's never left me. Doesn't mean that every day has been great. Doesn't mean that everything has been wonderful forever. But it's never left. And if you seek it, you'll find it. And it will change and it will move and it will morph and it will turn into something different. And so the setup for this workshop has been incredible, right? So we had Bruce talking to us about the spiritual experience and the spiritual appendix and what that means. And then, of course, the meeting last night, we were talking about Roland Hazard and kind of the experience that he was having with Dr. Young and kind of recap that a little bit. So, like, there's this guy named Carl Jung. Okay, he studied under Freud. Freud believed that everything was sexual in nature and that all of our problems are sex causes and all this. And the idea of, and I'm not a scholar in this, so I'm just kind of giving you general my understanding. Everything I say up here, if you can't reconcile it with something in the book, big book, or that's factual, then I'm wrong. Okay, I'm just telling you, this is Brandon's perspective on things. Okay, so Freud believed that everything that we do was driven from this desire to procreate and to demonstrate dominance through our sex. And then there's this guy Adler who studied under Freud, and Adler believed that it was a lust for power. That everything that anybody ever did was driven by this lust for power and control over other people. And then Jung, well, he was this other guy that had this is anybody a doctor? Pasha just had a seizure.
What?
I don't know. My wife's in the lodge, and she's 2 minutes ago. I guess that's why I had that here. But Freud believed that everything was, or I mean, Jung believed that we're spiritual beings, and that the solution was always spiritual, right? So this guy Roland Hazard, right? So he goes and he studies under Jung, but he doesn't like study under Jung. Like, he literally goes to Switzerland and lives with a dude for a year, right? And they work through all the inner springs of the mind, all the inner workings, and all the stuff, right? And Roland leaves there with this knowledge, the self-knowledge, right? He's got his triggers list. He's got his relapse prevention program. He knows to stay away from people, places, and things, right? He's got his backpack of all of his tools for sobriety. And he goes and he visits some friends, like in France or something like that, before he takes the boat back over to the United States. And they celebrate with a little champagne toast, and Roland's hammered. And he's hammered the whole way back. This is the way it's described in the book. So he returned to the doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. Okay, so this is the way that I see it, because my mind works in kind of funny ways. So Roland, he comes back, the ship comes back into port, and he's part of a wealthy family that he was supposed to take over the family business. And I just imagine that his parents went there to go visit him, and Roland's coming down the gangplank drunk. Mom, Dad, good to see you, you know. And his dad is just like, I just spent so much money to have you go live with that doctor. You go back and you talk to him and you find out what happened. So this line right here where it says, so he returned to the doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. The way I kind of see that is Roland came back over and he goes, so my dad wants to know why it didn't work. Okay. And then Roland tells him, well, basically it's because you're fucked. Okay? There's nothing you could do ever. Okay? There's two components to the first step. The first component is we're powerless over alcohol, right? What does powerless mean?
Lack of power.
No power, right? So these people that work the steps and think that they now have a choice of whether or not they drink or not, they don't got what I got. Some of the most misunderstood pages of the big book are pages 23 to 43, where it talks about the fact that I have no power, choice, and control. There is nothing that I can ever do, ever, 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 on my own power to stay sober. What the first step tells me is that I'm fucked. And if I can truly grasp that I have no power and that I'm fucked, then I might endeavor to unfuck myself. But if you still think that you have power, then you're going to continue to do a bunch of things thinking that you have something to do about it. And the rest of the steps, although you might have an experience, you will never access that power. Okay? So Roland says, or so Young tells Roland, you know, basically every once in a while these alcoholics have vital spiritual experiences. To me, they're phenomenon, right? So what he's talking about is the guy that like is a drunk, he's driving drunk, he drives his car off the bridge, falls into a freezing ice cold river, dies, comes back to life, and all of a sudden has a spiritual experience because he saw God and doesn't want to drink anymore. So if you can produce that, then do that. But if you can't, then there's nothing you can do, right? And so the idea of surrender is that I can't do anything about it. So Bill later on writes this letter to Roland, and he says, he tells him basically the fact that the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous came from Roland carrying the message to this guy named Debbie Thatcher. And then Debbie Thatcher carried the message to this guy named Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson met this guy named Dr. Bob Smith. And then Dr. Bob and Bill went and met this guy named Bill Dodson, right? See, Abby was 2 months sober when he carried the message to Bill. Okay? Bill was 6 months sober when he carried the message to Bob. And Bob was 2 weeks sober when he carried the message to Bill Dodson. When I found that new sponsor, 90 Days Sober, he had 30 days less than me, but he was 5 steps ahead of me. And he was able to transmit an experience to me that kept me sober. Now, he didn't stay sober, but he transmitted the message to me. So Bill writes Carl Jung and tells him about Roland Hazard, and then Carl responds and he says, "Dear Mr. W, your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H anymore, and I wondered what has been his fate. Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. The reason that I could not tell him everything was that in those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland, but what I really thought about was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent of a low level of a thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language as the union with God. How could one formulate such an insight in a language that is not misunderstood in our days? The only right and legitimate way to have such an experience is that it happens to you in reality, and it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to a higher understanding. You might be led to that goal by an act of grace, or through a personal and honest contact with friends, or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines of our mere rationalism. I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best one. I am strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world leads the unrecognized spiritual need to perdition. If it is not counteracted either by real religious insight or by the protective wall of human community, an ordinary man, not protected by an action from above and isolated in society, cannot resist the power of evil, which is called very aptly the devil. But the use of such word arouses so many mistakes that one can only keep aloof from them as much as possible. These are the reasons why I could not give a full and sufficient explanation to Roland. But I am risking it with you because I conclude from your very decent and honest letter that you have acquired a point of view above the misleading platitudes one usually hears about alcoholism. You see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus. And you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum. Spirit conquers spirit. Thank you again for your letter. I remain yours sincerely, C.G. Young. So you see, we have to have some sort of spiritual experience, but the problem that most of us have is that we're all stuck in this idea of we think we know some shit, right? So here's a parable for you. In a mother's womb, there were two babies. The first baby asked the other one, "Do you believe in life after birth?" The second baby replies, "Why, of course. There has to be something after birth. Maybe we are here to prepare ourselves for what we will be later." "Nonsense," said the first. "There is no life after birth. What would that life be?" "I don't know, but there will be more light than here. Maybe we will walk with our legs and eat with our mouths." The doubting baby laughs. "This is absurd. Walking is impossible. And eat with your mouths? Ridiculous. The umbilical cord supplies nutrition. Life after birth is to be excluded. The umbilical cord is too short." The second baby held his ground. "I think there is something, and maybe it's different than it is here." The first baby replied, "No one has ever come back from there. Birth is the end of life. And in the afterbirth, it is nothing but darkness and anxiety, and it takes us nowhere." "Well, I don't know," said the twin. "But certainly we will see Mother, and she will care for us." "Mother? You believe in Mother? Where is she now?" The second baby calmly and patiently tried to explain. "She is all around us. It is in her that we live. Without her, there would not be this world." "Ha! I don't see her. So it's only logical that she doesn't exist." To which the other replied, "Sometimes, when you're in silence, you can hear her. You can perceive her. I believe there is a reality after birth. And we are here to prepare ourselves for that reality when it comes." So we're in this space where preconceived ideas and opinions, right? We can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial, right? Can't be. Well, here is one of the truths that I've learned, is that if you believe something to be or to not be, you're right. 100%. And you will construct all sorts of experiences to guarantee that your perception and your belief is the only one. Let me explain to you an experience I had with my stepson that was wonderful, that outlines this perfectly. So I was in the other room, and his mother was suggesting to him science fair projects. And she's coming up with some great ideas, and she would suggest something, and he'd go, "That won't work." She'd suggest something else, and he'd say, "That won't work, that won't work, that won't work, that won't work." None of it would work. And I came out of the other room, and I walked in the room, and I was just kind of passing through, and I said, "Phoenix, you're right," which he liked. But he also knows me, so he's kind of like, "Wait a minute." And I said, "You're right, none of those things will work." Now he's very confused. I said, Phoenix, tell me to touch the ceiling. Now, this is a kid that's like, he was a little bit shorter, and he had this obsession with jumping and touching the ceiling. And like, he'd come running through the living room, and he'd try to jump, and he was always like 6 inches short of it, right? So I said, Phoenix, touch the ceiling. He said, I can't. I said, I know, but touch the ceiling anyways. Just humor me. Try. So he kind of, I was like, now tell me to touch the ceiling. He said, you're taller. I know you can do it. I was like, come on, play with me. Tell me to touch the ceiling. He goes, touch the ceiling. So I walk over in the kitchen. I pull out a bar stool and I put my hands and my face on the ceiling. I said, I'm touching the ceiling. He said, well, you never said I could. I was like, I never said you couldn't. You see, you could have gotten on the bar stool and touched the ceiling. You could have jumped off the couch. You could have climbed up on the counter. You could have gone outside, gotten a ladder. But the fact that you believed you could not touch the ceiling, you couldn't. And you constructed an experience that proves that you couldn't touch the ceiling. But the minute that it's possible to touch the ceiling, and you believe you can, the options are endless. So if God doesn't exist, you're right. If God exists, you're right. But one of my mentors, he's got this thing called the set-aside prayer. It says, please allow me to set aside everything I think I know about you, this, the big book, everything. And the purpose of the set-aside prayer is to set aside what I think I know so that I can have a new experience with whatever I'm having an experience with. That doesn't say throw it away. It doesn't say leave it out there and never come back to it. It says set it aside. Have a new experience. After you have a new experience, then go grab the pieces of information that are part of that old experience that are useful to you. If they're not useful, leave them over there. We carry around so much clutter, so much stuff in our lives that we can't have a true experience with anything. I'm too busy judging you, thinking I know what you are based on the way that you look, where you came from, the way you speak. I cannot experience you for you. And the experience of you is more than just the time that I'm spending with you. It's so much more vast. But what if I was present to that? You ever been wrong about anything before? Perhaps you're wrong about this. You see, the day that I left that meeting where I announced that I was an alcoholic in the meeting and picked up my chips, I left there and I'm driving home in my wife's car, going back to my temporary job while I'm 37 years old living with my parents. And the thought hits me of, if I was wrong about that, what else am I wrong about? And then experience opened up for me and things started happening. That first part of the first step is so important. Is, do I believe I'm powerless? Does my experience abundantly confirm? There's no hope for me in the first step. None. My experience with the first step says that there's nothing that I could ever, ever do by myself to stay sober. And so, what is your current first step experience? I meant to do this at the beginning. So, who in here has less than 30 days? Okay. Who in here has between 30 days and 6 months? Okay, that's bulk of the room. 6 months and a year? Okay. Year to two? 2 to 5? 5 to 10? 10 plus? Okay, so you 10 pluses. What are you powerless over today? You see, that for me to continually, see, the steps for me have to have a practical application, or I'm not going to do them, and I'm not going to keep doing them. If I think that the steps are the thing that are gonna, that's going to get me sober, I'm going to do this one time and that's it. Better make sure you do it perfect. If you're only going to do the steps one time, better make sure that you do it perfect. No mistakes. But see, what I've learned is that as I grow and as I remove some of the wreckage of my past, new things start to show up in my life. And new areas of my life that I thought I had under control, I no longer do. I was 3.5 years sober before fear showed up. It was the craziest thing. I had done an inventory at 6 months. I did another inventory. And when I say inventory, like when I go back through the steps, I start at one. What am I powerless over today? Go all the way through 9. When I go back through, I start at the beginning, go all the way back through. Because if I don't know what I'm powerless over, I don't know what I'm working the steps about. The people that don't rework the steps, they think that you're still working on that old stuff. You're not. Something new's shown up. Were you having trouble in personal relationships? Were you having trouble controlling your emotional natures? Were you to prey in misery? Were you depressed? Were you struggling to make a living? What are the things that you used to do that you don't do anymore? What are the things in your life that used to give you joy that you don't participate in? Outside from drinking and drugging, of course. And so what is my first step experience today? And can I do something about it? Do I think I can manage my finances? Do I think I can manage my relationship? My career? My spiritual life? Because if I think that I can manage it, I don't need God. And then we got that second half of the first step. The dash is a grammatical term or tool, which is, it's a connected but independent thought. We were powerless over drugs and alcohol, dash, that our life was unmanageable. My life is not unmanageable because of the drugs and alcohol, though the drugs and alcohol make my unmanageability worse. Is my life manageable today? I just completed going through the steps for the 7th time, and I'd like to report to you that at 11 plus years, my life is still not manageable. I still cannot get people to act right. People don't show up the right way, talk the right way, say the right things, manage the meetings that I want them to manage the right way. And so these people are all in my inventory, and I go back through that process, and then we get to the second step, and the second step says, is it possible, that there's some power out there? Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power that exists? Define it however you want to define it. It doesn't matter. The more definite your God or whatever your experience is, the less power your God's got. I don't even like using the word him anymore because that's limited. To me, God's everything. If God is everything, it's not a him or a her or an it or anything. It's just, it is. And so for me, like it has to be bigger. It has to be more expansive. Think about this. Like the thing that created everything, whatever that is, everything originated from some source, right? Like, because we can't have something come from nothing, right? Something had to exist before something else could exist. So whatever that thing is that existed in the beginning of existence before anything existed had to exist in order for us to exist now. So if I cut a tomato in half, is it still a tomato? If I cut that in half, is it still a tomato? How many times do I have to cut the tomato in half before it's no longer a tomato? It's a tomato forever, right? So if everything originated from source, then I'm that. I'm not all of it, but I'm some of it. I'm that thing on the outer edge of whatever that is. Can I access whatever that is within me that's part of me that is that? Because if I can access that, then we're dealing with some real power. Then we're dealing with the thing that created everything, but it can't manage my finances. It can't help me in my relationships. Really? Took away my alcoholism, the thing that I struggled with more than anything ever, but it can't do this? What if it could? Well, what if I work the steps as if that thing can, because I know I can't? Because you see, if I get to that third step, then the prayer is the affirmation of the fact that there's nothing I can do, and I hope that whatever this thing is can. And the people that really mean what they say in the third step, you can watch their actions in nine. The people that don't truly do the third step, they got a ton of unfinished amends over here. Okay? The tenth step says we have entered the world of the Spirit. Okay? It also says that we commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. Okay? So in order to operate in the tenth step, I have to function in a way that I have cleaned up the past. Now, here comes the rub, is that when I'm new, I can't see how those amends and not doing them are connected to me drinking again. Can't do it. Because I'm too busy thinking about what they did or how they were and all this other stuff, right? But if I've got a guide who's properly armed with facts about himself or herself, then they can take me through this process where I look at these pitiful resentments and I see how perhaps, just maybe, I've got a flawed perspective, right? And one of the things that we hear in a bunch of our meetings, and I have no idea where it came from because I can't find it in any of our literature. When we get over to column 4, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. See, in meetings I go to, whenever we're talking about the fourth step, they talk about my part. My part, my part, my part, my part, my part. Well, if I got a part, what does that mean you got? Part two. So it means when I get to amends and I go to make amends for my part, what am I going to expect out of you? You to take care of your part. But if I'm looking for my mistakes, it doesn't matter what you did. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been frightened? And then as I do this process, what I start to understand is that I believe after being here for a period of time, everything boils down to two things, is fear and pride. And if pride is that I'm simply afraid that you're not going to view me the way that I think I'm supposed to be viewed, everything's fear. But remember, I didn't have any fear when I showed up. Fear showed up when I was 3.5 years sober. So what had to happen is I had to start experiencing reality for what it was, and then fear started showing up and it started driving my life. And if it says, it's no big deal. It says over here that resentment is the number one offender. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, but we have been spiritually sick. Okay, it tells us that resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else, including drugs and alcohol. So when my spirit's sick, I can't see you. I can't experience you. And if you're a part of God, then I can't experience God. When I'm separated from you, I'm separated from God. If you really get into the study of a lot of the things that the basis of this book and Emmett Fox and the Sermon on the Mount, it talks about the fact that forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. It talks about the fact that if we haven't forgiven everybody else first, don't ask for any forgiveness. Because you're entering into spirit world expecting to get something that you haven't earned. And then I look at this conduct, and I look at this conduct and this pitiful way that I think that the opposite sex is supposed to treat me. And how I treat the opposite sex. or same-sex if that's your deal. But just how do you show up in intimate relationships? And then I go to in five, I go to somebody else and I take it to them and I say, look, this is what I think I see. And they go, oh man, no, you forgot this and this and this. And it says that we read this to another person or persons. And I've read inventory to multiple people, and the thing that I realize is that as I read more to more people, that number one, whatever that resentment and that fear had, the power it had over me, gets lessened. And I get a perspective that's actually honest, because it's my experience that by the time I'm reading it to the third or the fourth person, I forgot the role I was supposed to be playing in this whole deal. And they get the authentic truth. And I had read this piece of inventory to a guy I was probably about 5 years sober. And I'm talking, and he goes, man, you are one entitled motherfucker. And I was like, really? And I went through my notes from all the other people that had listen to that same inventory, and not a single one of them had that in there. But he saw it, and when he said it, and I looked at it, I'm like, oh, sure I am. Because I'm constantly looking to get things that I didn't earn. If I can get it from you quicker than I can go earn it, I'll get it from you. The cool thing is the spiritual world's set up that way. It's like, go learn from the experience of the people around you that they've had with whatever they call God and whatever they call existence. And learn and get launched, right? The terminology in this book is just so fascinating. Like, you say the third step prayer, then you skip a paragraph where it gives you the disclaimer of thinking well before you say the prayer. You know, the whammy comes at the end of the prayer instead of before the prayer. And then at the bottom of the page, it says this weird thing. It says next. So when do we start four after we say the prayer? Just gave you the answer. Next, right? Does anybody know what next means? Like now, right? And then it uses this terminology. Next, we launched. Anybody ever seen a rocket take off? What does that look like? Yeah, but like, what's going on behind the rocket, right? Fire and like just, what happens if the rocket doesn't move, you think? Huh. So you say the third step prayer and just kind of mosey on into four? Yeah. Or maybe launch. Get some fire under your ass and do this shit. And go to a different realm of existence, right? Maybe do that. That sounds cool. That everybody likes rockets, right? At least I think everybody does. Get out there. Get way out there. And then realize you have no business being way out there because you don't even know how to be here yet. And then we got these two steps that occupy two paragraphs in our book. And there's so much in them, right? Are we now ready to let God remove all these things that we find objectionable? There's two questions in that. The second question comes first. Is the way that I've been objectionable to me? If it is, can God have it? If it's not objectionable, keep rocking it, man. If your life run on self-will or run on whatever you're doing or what the God that you got is working, keep rocking it. If it's not working, maybe pick a new one. And there's a prayer in here, which until recently I didn't even realize was in here. You know, anytime the book says we ask God, that's a prayer. What page are you wondering? 76. If we still cling to something, we will not let go of. We ask God to help us be willing. There's a prayer. God, help me be willing. You see, I still think that I'm getting some use out of these defects, and I don't want to change. Do something with your boy. Do something with your boy. Help me see it. Now, if I ask God, what's going to happen is God's probably going to crush me with that defect over and over and over and over until I want to change. And then the seventh step prayer. I don't know why people say the third step prayer all the time. The seventh step prayer is where it's at. Yeah. My Creator, I'm now willing that you have all of me, good and bad, all that crap. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect or character which stands in my way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. You know what that says? I cannot do anything about my defects. Hear people talk about it in meetings. I'm just going to go home and work on my defects and crush my ego. Good luck. Two of the defects God hasn't sought to remove from me yet is I like to think I know what I'm talking about, and I like to be the center of attention. God's using it right now. Right? Now here's the difference. Is the way that I used to be, I would have used the podium the way that they had the room set up earlier. I would have been up there on my high horse telling you guys all how I'm doing it and how you're doing it wrong. I didn't like the energy of it. I want to be able to see everybody. I want the energy to be like the steps. You see, my first step started in the heart of somebody else's 12th step. And then I work the steps. And then I come back. And I carry the message to somebody else. And they carry it to somebody else. And the steps are cyclical. So the circle, the energy field that we're in now, there's give and take. I don't know what you guys need to hear. That's why I don't prepare. My sponsor and I do workshops all the time. And we have no idea what that group of spirit wants us to say and do. And we'll be sitting there in the middle of a session, and a guy that hadn't been paying attention to us at all, over there in that corner, way back in that corner, right? He'll send up a flare. Because we connected. Our spirit touched his spirit. And now he's with us. And we pick up another guy. And then we pick up another guy. And then there was that guy that sat in the front row right over there and stared at the wall. Because he didn't want to be there. And he had to be there. And he was going to not listen at all. Motherfucker did the best meditation for an entire weekend. Staring at the fucking wall. Just not listening. And he didn't. He won. And then I acknowledged him at the end and told him that if he ever claims he can't meditate, he's wrong. And the whole room laughed, and he had no idea what was going on because he was too busy meditating on that wall, being pissed at everybody and everything in it. If you're disturbed by anything I've said, you should look at it. It's a signal. It's a signpost. Hey, pay attention. Your spirit is telling you there's more. There's more. There's more. Because the thing that I know after being here for a while is that sometimes God picks sponsors. Spirit tells people what to say. Spirit tells people where to go. One of the biggest things that I've struggled with in my recovery is thinking, realizing that other people have intuition too. Because I think mine's the best. Because it's mine. So I got to realize sometimes when I get up against somebody else's intuition that they got it too. And that they're doing what they're supposed to do. You see, I wanted my wife to come sit with me at the fire pit last night. And she's figured out how to talk to me. She was sitting in the lodge by the fireplace, and she says, "I'm supposed to be here right now." Can't argue with that. I said, are you okay if I go to the fire pit? And she says, yeah. Now, I had no idea why she felt that. She knew she was supposed to be there. And then it was reported to me later on that she was supposed to be there for a very specific reason. to have a very specific conversation with a very specific person. She didn't know it. I didn't know it. That person didn't know it either. But they had it. And so, what I hope I've done in this first session is to challenge you on what you think you know about what you think you know. Because you see, to me, step seven is kind of like the peak of the mountain where all the work that we've done to this point, we'll find out how good it was by the momentum we catch on the other side of the hill. Because if the work that you've been putting in was kind of like this, your momentum coming out of seven is going to be like this. If the momentum that you put in the first seven steps is like this, you're going to scream through those amends. You're going to launch out into steps 10 and 11. And you're going to enter the world of the Spirit. And you're going to be able to touch people and experience things that you never believed were possible. I think the only choice we have here is the amount of effort that we put into it. And I'm not even sure that we have that choice either. Because if God is everything, it's that too. So we'll take a pause there, and Adam's going to lead us in some sort of prayer. It can be the serenity prayer. Oh, Adam. It could be the serenity prayer. It could be whatever you want.
Take a pause for the people who are still out there, sick and suffering. Who woke us up this morning?
Our Father, who art in heaven. What do you want?
I was going to do serenity.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
So
take two.
Who woke us up this morning?
God.